Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, we hear from writer and eco-activist Victoria White on how climate change action not only means everyone doing their bit, it requires a radical shift in policy too. If you're someone who enjoys a leisurely seashore walk combined with a little bit of fact-finding en route, the National Biodiversity Data Centre wants to hear from you. And archaeologist, historian and presenter of the landmark TV series Coast, Neil Oliver, shares his unique window on the world with Dr. Richard Collins.
The jagged edge of Cornwall jabs defiantly into the Atlantic. Only the most durable rock can resist that ocean's pounding. This tough coastline doesn't give up its treasures easily. But from the earliest times, men have been drawn here to pit themselves against the granite.
And what a beautiful series it is, too.
Here he is at last, the mystery man of India. Our first glimpse as the Rajputana came alongside at Marseille. And there's a woman of whom you've probably all read, but never seen in a picture. Miss Madeleine Slade, the English daughter of an admiral, who now prefers to be known as Malala Ben. And just behind her comes Mr. Gandhi, dressed as he said he would be, in just his loincloth, even in the chilly climes of Europe. And he's carrying with him his pots and pans, which he declared at the customs.
Mahatma Gandhi urged his supporters to be the change that you wish to see in the world. So when it comes to the environment, are people actually prepared to make the necessary lifestyle changes to combat climate change? And could collective green changes undertaken by individuals really be enough to make a difference? Freelance writer Victoria White, who's been living the greener lifestyle longer than most, believes it's going to take a whole lot more than that. Eanan Ilana recently met Victoria at her Dublin home.
I am here in the leafy suburbs of Milltown in the wonderful back garden that runs down to the Dodder. And the back garden belongs to Victoria White, who is here beside me with a large cup of coffee. How are you, Victoria?
Grand. All the better for the coffee.
So you're a freelance writer and a carer when you have four children and you have this wonderful garden.
Yes, I do. Yeah, lucky me. That's the essence of it. Yeah, bit of luck, that's all.
Yes, I know, and you really have it a most wonderful garden because it's a wild garden. It's not all manicured and every plant that is wanted, rudely described as a weed and vanished. You have all sorts of lovely plants here. But the garden is not as it seems. It seems a small enough garden here, the bit I'm in, but there's more to it, isn't there, Victoria?
Yes, there's this kind of a second. You go down a very steep, dangerous steps, and there's a second part of the garden which was originally a floodplain for the River Dodder, I think, and also this was a milling area, so it held also a mill race. And there was a mill race there when we came at the bottom of the garden, and lumps of iron from the old ironworks of the River Dodder. So there's a second bit of the garden that is reclaimed floodplain. Yeah, and it's even wilder. It's like a kind of a bonus garden. It's a kind of an additional secret garden, someone said the house should be called. And it's wild enough. And then you have a big, a wonderful big wall, 18th or 19th century wall, between one end of the garden, between one level of the garden and the other. And it's full of vegetation as well, full of ivy. And I mean, my garden's wild, you know. I mean, really, this is a wild space beside the river. Rather than a garden. And a lot of it was, you know, there was a very fond gardener here before me, the Roycroft family, and they planted the apple trees, and they were clearly people who just loved the environment. I always think the Roycroft name comes from West Cork, and there's a lot of Montbretia here in the garden, and really I feel that I'm in a little bit of, you know, the southwest kind of when I'm here.
And with fuchsia.
Yes, fuchsia and wild garlic that we brought from West Cork, further up in the other part of the garden, and it's a wonderful, you know, sort of snowdrifts of flowers in the early summer. So we use that in salads. It's great.
So it's certainly a green space, and it goes right there in the wall at the end, and then the River Dodder on the other side. Mm. So it's a really Rus and Urbis, isn't that what they call it?
Rural life. I mean, gosh, we sound like here where it's a property, you know, property porn, they like to call it. But I just had this vision. I suppose I grew up in a huge suburban garden with an old, bordered by an old wall near the sea in Blackrock. And I just had this desire to have a garden that bordered on a geographical feature rather than another person's garden. William Blake has a poem about walking through chartered streets, the chartered streets of London. And I felt that I was living in like a little shoebox in a chartered space. And it was the beautiful summers of the mid-2000s. I walked down the River Dodder and I looked to the back of houses and I thought, gosh, I'd love a space like that. I never thought I would ever be able to have one. But not everybody wants a big dishevelled space backing onto a river. And luckily they didn't, because we did. The house was in bad order. But it was September, there were blackberries, there were apples, there was the sun facing onto the trees, and I completely fell in love with it. I just wanted it, and that was it.
How long are you here now?
We're here 12 years.
And you never regretted it for a single day?
No, I love it. I mean, you know, because I work from home, my home environment is incredibly important to me. And really, when I'm looking back at my life, I realise that a very large part of the reason that I gave up my office job in the early 2000s as a newspaper person was because I couldn't stand the lack of natural light, and I couldn't stand the lack of access to nature. And I mean, that might sound terribly hippy-dippy and everything, but that's just me, you know. I mean, I grew up I grew up in an incredible garden because my mother was from rural Donegal. She kind of created that in a suburb of Blackrock. And so I just, at a certain age, I was gasping for green, gasping for natural light. And so that I have here. The guys have, you know, suburbs aren't particularly wonderful for teenagers, or, you know, I mean, they don't think it's just so fantastic that we have this. So, like, that's kind of a little bit, no, you know.
I suppose
not.
When you get too big to play in the garden, you want greener fields.
The one thing is that, as I said, there's two levels to the garden, so they can do an awful lot in the bottom level without us being able to see. And that is great, because kids nowadays, there are too many eyes on them too much of the time. So it gives them a space to play without my prying eyes. Yeah, and I work in the bottom garden as well, which is just an absolute privilege. The bird life that I see here, I see, like, when the apple blossoms come out, I see incredible bullfinches.
Yes, bullfinches. Yeah, great.
And, like, I never got them at home when I was growing up in Booterstown. And, like, my granny had a beautiful picture on a tile of apple blossom and bullfinch, and which I now have, and I see it constantly in front of me when I'm working, and it's wonderful. And I sent a picture of it to my sister who lives in Australia and said, you know, granny's picture is now in front of us. And she sent me a picture of lorikeets on a Granny Smith tree from Australia.
Pick your tree, pick your country. But I mean, speaking of Australia and speaking of here and speaking of climate change, how do you feel it's all panning out? Are we going to hell in a handcart? Is composting our tea bags and living a personal life that's free from sin, if you like, is this the way forward?
You know, it's not. I mean, of course it's not. I mean, I was very resistant to anybody looking at me and saying, what do you do personally in your personal life? I mean, I'm not going to sit in this stunning garden virtue signalling for Ireland. I'm not going to do that, because somebody living in a very small flat with no car in the inner city, whose house is freezing and who can't afford to heat it, has a much lower carbon footprint than I do. So, really, the thing is, we need system change. And it's a decade old, this business of, you know, I mean, the great thing was the Guardian editor said his car was greener than David Cameron's. That was, you know, the mid-2000s. And now look, David Cameron sprung Brexit on us, and the climate implications potentially of Brexit, for instance, you know. So, like, personal lifestyle choices, what they have to be mass changes, is they need to be affordable and they need to be practical. That's the thing. It needs to be easy. Like, why do I cycle everywhere? Well, I cycle everywhere because when I was a student, I didn't have money for the bus. Well, at least if I paid for the bus, I had no money for my half pints of Guinness. So, of course, I managed to get on my old Triumph 20 I'd had as a child, and I pedalled in for all I was worth. So I developed a habit. And now, why do I cycle? Well, I can't imagine not cycling, because it's the quickest, the easiest. I just don't know how people live when they don't cycle. I mean, and of course, it costs me nothing. So, yeah, I mean, am I trying to save the planet by cycling? Absolutely not. No, I'm just trying to get where I need to go in time.
So you think it's gone beyond a personal choice and that it has become a government choice. Big decisions have to be made. And you'd cycle more if there were more lanes to cycle on, for example. So therefore, what do you think of this terrible protest that's in some parts of Dublin whereby in order to make the cycle lanes and the bus lanes, we have to reduce people's front gardens and remove trees that are in their front gardens?
Well, we don't have to. We have to make a choice, and that's that the cars, there should be fewer cars. We have allowed the car to dominate. And remember that 30% of Dubliners don't have a car. It's not free to have a car. It's extremely expensive to have a car. So we've allowed somebody who, I mean, in very recent times would have been only somebody of a certain, you know, of a certain economic status to dominate the roads. And, you know, that's the problem. The problem is that the walker is first impacted, and then the cyclist is impacted, but the motorist can't be impacted. So ultimately we must save the trees, save the front gardens, and reduce the cars. Not that I have any problem with the cars. As I said, I have a car, I drive myself, but they're not fit for purpose in this inner Dublin, which it is.
In this medieval city, which was 1,000 years old, and other European cities have very little access by their cars, and people are able to survive there. So we need to change the emphasis, you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got to change the model, and the funding model has to change. Like, it has to be the 2-to-1 in favour of walking and cycling rather than cars. But instead, what we're doing is we're widening all the access roads to Dublin. And where are those cars going to go? They won't vanish, you know, once they get into the city. We've really got to change. We're one of the most congested cities in Europe.
1/5 of our emissions come from transport, but 1/3 of our emissions come from agriculture. Yeah. Now, how can we do this, seeing as how, I know this is an awful pun, but I'm going to make it anyway. It's the sacred cow, isn't it, of this. It can't be mentioned. What do you think? Can you mention it?
Absolutely. It is being mentioned now. I mean, everything's changed now, I think. One thing that really changed people was, I think, the Eat Lancet report that came out earlier in the year, which really said we've got to eat, you know, yes, we can eat a small amount of red meat. So it's not this kind of just something dangerous about this, which I hate. I hate that stuff. But like they say, eat that. It's a small meatball a day you can get away with for the planet, for your children's future and for your health. So I adopted the Eat Lancet diet in my home. Now, my kids, they might be eating nothing but chicken fillet rolls when they leave the house, and that's fine. But I do it in this house. So I'm thinking, we're talking here about consumption levels in the developed world of these products are going down because people know that it's not good for the planet, it's not good for their health, and they've access to other food. So really, what we need to do is The new cap, when it comes out, needs to, common agricultural policy, needs to change farming to take account of these new realities and consumer trends and also of the planet's health, rewarding farmers for being custodians of their land and custodians of carbon sinks rather than for producing beef, because it doesn't pay them anything to produce beef. They only gain subsidies from it.
Yes, certainly the common agricultural policy has very much influenced how people farm. I know certainly in the 80s there was all these grants to have sheep, and we had 8 million sheep in Ireland, and they ate the mountainsides bare.
Right.
Then the people got grants to get rid of the sheep, and they got rid of the sheep, and we're down to 3 million sheep now. So now the story is with the cattle. So, I mean, it's not really, in a way, whether people eat steak every day of the week or not. It's if it is not, if it's done at a higher level, that it makes it different, then that's the way to go, is it not?
Well, yes, but we need fewer cattle. And there's just no nice way of putting that. And all this business, I mean, of, you know, oh, well, our beef is the most, you know, carbon efficient. Now, it is in question. I mean, that is highly, not all reports find that to be the case. A recent UN report find it to be highly carbon intense, actually, our product. But you know, a spade, we have to call a spade a spade. We're in a situation of climate breakdown already. And we have been, in the last 5 years, we've imported fodder from abroad to feed our cattle because we haven't had the fodder in the ground to feed them. And I mean, this reminds me of, you know, the monocrop failure of the Great Famine and us trying to importing Indian meal. Like, our land was overstocked before the abolition of milk quotas. And you can't just keep on putting cattle on the land and expect the land to still pay you back. And I mean, yes, we've got to absolutely simply have a smaller national herd, and that's the fact. Farmers need to be properly paid. They're not being paid. We're creating high quality beef to make beef burgers. That's just ridiculous. The food producer should be getting far more of the benefit of a smaller amount of product.
The other big emitter of carbon into the atmosphere is energy creation. So a third from agriculture, a fifth from transport, and a fifth from energy, electricity, yeah, made from burning fossil fuels.
Yeah.
What do you? What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, like, we're meant to have a climate emergency as declared in the Dáil, and we're still making electricity with coal. And Moneypoint, which creates electricity with coal, was out of commission for, I think, nearly 3 months, and we survived. So, like, basically, if Minister Bruton was serious, like, tomorrow Moneypoint should be shut down. Clearly, you have to protect the livelihoods of the people involved. There's no question about that. Then the peat burning is going to go on until 2027. And really, what the hell is that about? I mean, you know, we are ripping up. That's when there won't be any left to burn. And it's like what we did with the blue whales. You know, we stopped hunting them when there were none. It always reminds me of that. Like, our bogs are vital carbon sinks, and we are stripping them in order to burn them to make electricity, you know. And I mean, we have to, like, there has to be system change that we see as an emergency. The people have heard an emergency declared in the Dáil. They need to see the emergency in action. And we have also full employment. This is the moment to do it. Those people who are engaged with the peat production, which, you know, which essentially earns us nothing as well, I have to say, divert the money into maintaining the livelihood of those people, and re-divert some of them, those who can or wish to, into retrofitting homes. Because our biggest problem now with insulation is that we don't have the tradespeople to actually put in the insulation. And some of them have similar skills to those who are employed by Bord na Mona.
So you don't advocate sitting at home and putting on an extra jumper? You do think it's a good idea to make your house a bit warmer?
Well, look, I'm not going to advocate for anyone to put on a jumper when I've got a heat pump and a beautifully insulated house. But and it's absolutely fantastic. And I wish...
How does a heat pump work now? We read about it in the paper all the time. But here you are with a heat pump.
Yeah.
You switch on a machine.
Well, do you know how your computer works? You know, I mean...
No. I know how to turn it on.
I know how to turn it.
When you come into your house and...
You do nothing.
What is it?
Okay, it's a thing that looks like an air conditioning unit. And the nice man put it in about a year and a half ago and turned it on, and that's it. I've had nothing to do with it since. So all I can do sometimes is I can alter the thermostat in the rooms, but it keeps everything at a consistent temperature. It's absolutely amazing. There's constant hot water, but I have solar for my hot water during the summer, and it talks to the solar, so it doesn't work to produce hot water when the solar is producing it. So I just do nothing, and I have incredibly low electricity bills.
Where does the heat pump get the heat from?
Well, there's a big question. Apparently, it's the same as a fridge, but the other way around. But I don't know how a fridge works. So it's apparently it uses the difference between the outside temperature and the inside temperature. But I mean, do we really know very much about how the things we have in our houses work?
I don't know how it works.
I just know it does work. It does work. But I mean,
no, this is not a leave and say question. And yeah, the reason why I'm asking you is because we hear so much about heat pumps all over the place, and nobody ever explains to anybody what a heat pump is.
Yeah.
People think, oh, is this going to be a great hole in the ground and getting geothermal?
It's literally the as I said. I mean, we got a contractor
ambient air in the room,
and he put a thing outside. It has to be outside, a thing that looks like an air conditioning unit outside, so it looks exactly like an air conditioning unit. It is exactly, it's very similar in what it is. And hooked it up to what was an old vestigial gas heating system, and that was it. I mean, did it in a day, and there was no impact of any type. And from then on, the house is always warm. It has to, your house has to be insulated, or else it's not economically viable. So our house was, the most important thing is insulation. But that's all very well, but we had the money to put up front, you know, and we knew a little bit about it, so that when we were doing big job on our house 10 years ago, insulation was the number one thing. And I mean, there are people, many, many people people did jobs then in the end of the Celtic Tiger with no insulation, and that's just an absolute crying shame. And so I really do applaud what's in the new climate plan, is that you won't be able to do a big retrofit without improving the BER and rating. And, you know, I mean, our BER rating is really good in this house. I mean, it was an absolute shell, I mean, in terms of it had no BER rating, really, and now it's a B1.
Yeah, which shows that it does work, and this thing, and presumably it works on electricity.
But not very much. But now, look, I mean, it will pay you back. But here's the thing: most people don't have money to put up front, and I mean, it was very tough for us as well, I have to say. But we found it. And the thing is, some people don't have access to credit. And so what you need to do is you need to front load the savings for individuals in order to make that system change. Maybe start with public housing and just go at it, you know. Go at it seriously here, you know.
Would you like to be the minister?
No, definitely not. I'd hate to be the minister. I don't want to be anywhere but in this garden.
speaking of this garden, coming back to basics, you know, when I come to visit people like yourselves, I'm always amazed at the wonderful things they're growing to eat. What do you grow to eat?
Well, you know, I don't do very much, I have to say, but I have fruit, I have lettuce, and I have herbs. They're my main things, because they're the most valuable things to grow in your garden, because they're the things you need to tend the whole time. They're the things that are expensive and that are hard to transport. So those are the worthwhile things, because we're living in a situation where, you know, carrots, you know, are very, very cheap. I'm sorry. They're, you know, it's not good, but it's true. I'm feeding four children. So what I have here is I have apples from the previous owner and some of my own. So I have two fabulous old Bramleys, and I have, and they last me the whole way. I do my Christmas puddings, everything, the whole way. I store them in the back garden on old apple stores they used to have, and they do me the whole year. And then I have eaters, and I have too many. I have to get them thinned. And then I have plums, and I have pears, and I have gooseberries, and I have red currants, white currants, blackberries.
And are these pears?
No, they're pears. I'm surprised at you.
No, they're blackberries. The ones above.
I've never eaten the cherries. I have raspberries, strawberries, loads of herbs of every type and denomination, and I have lettuce, of course, and salads. I mix salads. Now, I've bought Rocket loads of times and continually losing the packet. But normally I have lots of Rocket, lots of lettuce, and I love that. And as I said, I grew up in a garden where, you know, I walked out in the morning with my cornflakes bowl, and I put the raspberries on it. And my mother made bucket loads of jam, and I grew up with, you know, fresh potatoes out of the ground, boiled in mint. My mother would say, go out and get some mint, and then the whole house would be full of mint. And, you know, I grew up with going to cut lettuce, you know, in the summer. So I have this sense of summer abundance, and there's too much then for us to eat. But I like that, because that continually makes me, stimulates me to invite people to the house, you know, to sit outside and eat
and
the
share,
fruit.
Share the lettuce. Share
it. I love it. I mean, we all had our family had birthdays in the summer, and it was all about strawberries and raspberries and sitting outside and meringues. I finally cracked the meringue, meringue barrier. 10 years after my mother's dead, she's finally let me take her place as a meringue maker. And you know, sponges. I mean, all that stuff. The glory of an Irish summer. I adore it. I mean, I hate the winter. I hate the darkness of the winter, but I glory in this now. You know, it's gorgeous.
And you have the memory then of the associated food and the garden and the whole
nature. It's laid down early, so this is how important it is, I guess. I mean, you know, my kids scorn all this stuff, but like, I mean, it'll come back eventually. You know, that's the truth of it. It's the connection. I mean, food is how we engage with the environment in the most profound way. So it's actually to do with understanding the taste, the smells, the textures, the culture. And that's all to do with respect for the environment. It's interesting. Someone said to me recently, the word Eucharist is the same word, Efcharisto, which is in Greek, thank you. So basically, it's a thank you. To sit down at a meal together with people is a thank you for the fruits of the earth.
We have a wonderful, wonderfully appalling relationship with food generally in Ireland. Let's have our dinner now quick and get it over with. And the whole social thing about eating in company, that's completely gone in Ireland.
I agree with you, but I mean, this is where the business of climate change, you have to look at much, much wider things. You have to look at our focus on productivity. And I mean, what we need is more respect for recreation, leisure, for home-based work, for unpaid work, for the other side, the dark side of the moon, of the economy. And that is the least carbon intense side of the moon. And our entire focus is on just GDP or whatever as a that's no measure of well-being whatsoever. So we have to move to that in order to become a climate resilient society, I think.
So when the revolution comes, you'll be in the vanguard.
I know, probably I'll be in my garden.
Thank you very much, Victoria, for talking to me.
Freelance writer Victoria White speaking with Aina Nilauna.